ידיים עם סבון, למרות שנראה לי שכולם שוטפים ידיים. נראה לי שזה משהו היה, אולי זה תבלין ישן שיושב שם.
Okay, so this is our discussion period. Who would like to start? Yes?
I really like your presentation about Mara, and I remember it also from 2 years ago, and I really liked it then also, and incorporated it to my practice, to my teaching. But I'd like to, for a moment to play devil's advocate.
Very appropriate.
Mars advocate. And to take the, what you call the orthodox position, and ask if we go by the definition of awakening as the total eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion, and given that that was the experience of the Buddha, of his awakening, then, and if we go on the assumption that that Mara is the greed, hatred, and delusion, then how come Mara keeps encountering or visiting the Buddha after his awakening? It seems like a contradiction.
I think it is a contradiction because the primary assumption, I would argue, is incorrect. The primary assumption being that the Buddha's, the full awakening of the Buddha was the total eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion. We'll look at this tomorrow. But in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in the first discourse where the Buddha defines his awakening, he doesn't describe it in that way. So there are numerous passages where that is said, though, inevitably, that, as I quoted, the Buddha will say that the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion are cut off like a palm stump, never to occur again. So I think what we're looking at is that there are two quite different and conflicting narratives or accounts of what this awakening is. There's inconsistency within the canonical record. And you're quite right. If the Buddha has ridden himself of all these things, why does Mara keep appearing? You can't fit these two accounts together very easily. And it's quite, it's striking that very, the orthodox Buddhist schools, without exception, I would say, follow the line you advocate, the devil's advocate line. And yet we cannot deny the fact that there are numerous passages, a whole section of the Sanyutta Nikaya, which seems to be presenting another picture. But I think we can also look at this in terms of our understanding, our modern understanding of where greed, hatred, and delusion come from. I think, I would understand them, or let's say the most compelling account of the origin of these strong drives is that they are the legacy of our biological evolution. The greed and hatred and delusion, we really mean, self-centeredness, intense self-identity. These were survival strategies that enabled the human species to get to where we are now. We were very good, or our ancestors were very good, at getting what they wanted, getting rid of what they found got in their way, and persisting in a identity of self and mine that enabled them to plan and to work towards the survival in the next year. Now, in that sense, greed, hatred, and delusion are embedded in our reptilian brains, whereas Buddhist tradition has tended to see them as having nothing whatsoever to do with the body really, but being formless functions of some spiritual mind that goes from body to body, and that therefore spiritual or practices are adequate to actually getting rid of them. If we understand them as we do now, and I find that that explanation far more credible, then I think the Mara story makes a lot more sense. Yes. God.
From a different will.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is no problem, because then he is a certain being. And the text is quite clear that even there is many passages when it says that the Buddha is a master for humans and devas and maras.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
So there is, they look at it, and I think in the text, what I can detect, that there is always a kind of a play between the psychological realm and cosmological realm.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the jhanas. You can be reborn in jhana, and you can experience jhana while you're still in this realm. And in the same sense, Mara kind of is always kind of a play, and you have to kind of see. Sometimes it is greed, hatred, and delusion, and sometimes it is as a kind of being that comes and plays a role. And I can offer another suggestion that maybe, I don't see that the Buddha encountered Mara many times actually in the beginning. He's talking about Mara many times. But it's also a teaching device. It's kind of devil's advocate. You are a teacher, and you want to use a certain devil to play kind of the one, you know, in a teaching discourse. So this is another way to look at why Mara appears again and again. It's a way to use it when you have an audience, and you want to say, oh, yes. But I think the cosmology and psychology in the early text is quite clear that there is all the time kind of play between them.
Can you summarize it for those who have not heard it?
Did you hear that, everyone, or not, what Karen said?
Not much.
Not all. Okay, in brief, in the early text, we have to, this is Karen speaking, we need to recognize that Mara operates not just as a psychological device, in other words, referring to a certain inbuilt drives like greed, hatred, and delusion, but also that Mara operates as a cosmological element, that Mara is understood as also being a god, a deva, who is in a way belonging into another realm. And so Mara appears from this realm as a figure, as a demon, as it were, in the form of a demon, and then interacts with the Buddha. And we must not confuse the cosmological and the psychological functions of this particular figure. Moreover, Mara is also, it could simply be seen as a teaching device. In other words, in an audience of that time, if you want to get a point across in a more sort of symbolic language, then this is a very convenient way of describing something to certain audiences. Is that correct? More or less?
Mara also, because it is plural, the Maras.
Yeah, the Maras, yeah.
Maybe it's a class of being.
It is a class of being, yeah.
Only one.
Yeah.
That's
right.
The asuva types of the
Yes.
So, but I know that your assumption that there is no different realms and there is no. So this is the reason I offer this. I know that it doesn't correspond with your.
Yeah. Well, that's my thing. I don't inhabit a world. I don't believe in a world in which beings from other realms pop in and pop out. So I'm not persuaded by that particular aspect of the argument. But I do find, I agree with you, though, as a teaching device, it is a very powerful one. But as a teaching device, it personifies these elements. It makes them, in some sense, more complex and more human rather than as simple psychological states. And I feel that all of them are passages, are another way of talking about the condition we are in now. And they're also, and this we may disagree, it's a way of representing what was actually going on in the Buddha's own mind. There are a number of passages where the Mara comes to the Buddha. It's not just the Buddha talking about Mara. It's as though there's the farmer, for example. The Buddha's giving a talk, and they see a farmer on the horizon coming towards them, and the farmer asks the Buddha, "Where are my cows?" And the Buddha says, "I know you, Mara." There's many passages like that. When the Buddha suffers from the attack of Devadatta, and a rock is thrown at his ankle and his foot, then Mara comes to him, and this is a very beautiful passage, I don't have it by heart, but they engage in this dialogue. The Mara Samyutta, which is the collected discourses on Mara in the Samyutta Nikaya, offers many, many instances of this. But I think Karen is also right in that Mara does not just refer to the psychological. Mara is also identified with the khandhas themselves. Mara is actually the condition of the world we live in. Mara is the limit condition of the world. So in later Buddhism, they classify Mara as Yama Mara, Mara that is death. And again, Yama is also another being, but frankly, it refers to death. You have Khanda Mara. Mara is identified with the conditioned world itself. There's something limiting about the very structure of our bodies, our emotions, our minds, our perceptions, our consciousness. Mara saturates the world. In other words, limitation is built into the structure and the order of the world itself. Mara is then Kilesa Mara, the Mara of the defilements, and that's the psychological reading of Mara. And then, fourthly, Mara is called Devaputta Mara, and that's the Mara as a cosmological, literally it means an offspring of the son of the gods. So then there's Mara as a cosmological figure within ancient Indian cosmology. So yes, all of those features are elements of how Mara is represented in the canon. But my own sense of what this means, particularly for a contemporary audience, is that we are utilizing mythic language, symbolic language, to describe in often a more vivid and compelling way the condition or the human condition in which we find ourselves. Yes. Can you speak up a little bit?
In your book, there was a sentence about Mara saying that there's no Buddha without the Mara, which I find the most inspiring in this thing. So you talked about it a little bit in the end. My feeling is that it's more from the alchemistry or tantric way of looking, that the two of them growing together.
Mm-hmm. In the Pali Canon? Well, only implicitly, not explicitly. It's certainly true that in Vajrayana Buddhism, in the Tantric tradition, then the kilesas, the defilements, are no longer seen as things that you get rid of, but as things, or energies basically, that you transform. And so in the Tantric tradition, I think that is rooted in this idea of Mara, in recognizing that the human being is not split between a spiritual and good side and an unspiritual and a negative side, and the purpose of the practice is to get rid of the bad and cling on to the good. The Vajrayana tradition, which in a sense is a movement that characterized not only Buddhist but Indian thought in general, in the early, from about the 3rd to the 8th centuries AD, is I think an example of how Buddhist thinking changed through the course of its own development to see the so-called negative as simply, in the end, really just another configuration of energy, of power, of force, of mind, of body. And the purpose, therefore, becomes that of reconfiguring your experience rather than eliminating what you consider to be negative. So that certainly is one of the threads, one of the ways in which the later tradition began to look at these questions very differently. Did you have a question?
The question is similar to what Karen said, but I want to start one step back, that in the biblical tradition,
uh-huh,
we have Moses, who is considered the most saintly, the clearest, the most modest, and he doesn't lead the nation to the land of Israel, because he, according to the text, he takes the rod and he hits the stone.
Mm-hmm.
The biblical Buddha. At the end of his life, he can't be part of the story of redemption, because Mara, which is anger, and in rabbinical literature, at least anger is parallel to idol worship. To be angry is to believe that there's an ego, which is the highest.
Mm.
Our Buddha has Mara overtaking him, and he has to give over his rod, Joshua, to lead the nation into the land of redemption. And so from there I wanted to say, first of all, it creates a great affinity to hear your version of Buddha, because there's no Moses without the act of that, and there's no word modesty without knowing that the most modest in rabbinical literature, there was never a modest man like Moses, and that's why he was able to see God face to face, because his ego wasn't blocking.
Mm-hmm.
And even transparent consciousness can be afflicted by anger, by idol worship, by mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that your answer to Karen, and that I would, if you could go forward, I assume that what biblical and what your interpretation of Buddhist literature is saying is that the source of highest inspiration and consciousness is linked with the vulnerability to Mara. It's not that Moses, at the end of his life, he couldn't be a Moses.
Mm.
I assume that the biblical text is telling us there's something in a Moses, in a Buddha nature, that is highly vulnerable to Mara, and that to the end is in dialogue, and perhaps that the Buddha nature, and I think this is where Karen was taking it, is an outburst of a great intimacy with Mara.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid I can't rephrase that if you didn't hear. The one way I would take that further is that I think also Mara, towards the end of the Buddha's life, becomes primarily not an inner condition, but rather the socio and the political world that the Buddha is struggling within to present and to create his teaching and his community. And the last years of the Buddha's life, I touch on it in my book called The Kingdom of Mara, chapter in the book, in which Mara begins to assume the form of the powers of the world, the principalities and the powers is the word used by St. Paul. So Mara is also the actual the opposition within your own society to what it is that you are seeking to realize. And the Buddha, in a way, towards the end of his life, becomes completely caught up in the political events that eventually threaten to destroy everything that he is doing. And it's a very tragic story. I can't go into all the details now, but the book that I'm publishing next spring goes into this in quite some detail, although it doesn't speak of it specifically in terms of Mara. But I think Mara likewise saturates the social fabric, the ambitions of the people, of his family, of his tribe, and in a way bring him down. But there is, in that tragedy, in that failure, there is also paradoxically triumph. I think it's a similar thing also in the story of Jesus. I mean, the passion of Jesus, the crucifixion, the failure of everything is also paradoxically a triumph.
I don't agree about Moses. I think that the problem with Moses is actually the whole story about God like Moses and Moses like the people of Israel, and God cannot forgive him about this. But if to come back to the notion of that all the bad things, delusion, greed, everything is like someone that takes us. I think that it's very explicitly stated in after Cain.
Sorry, after
Cain.
Cain. Oh, Cain, right. Cain. Oh, Cain, yes.
Murder of Hevel, God tell him that the sin, it's very fully translation, the sin is always lurking there for an opening, and he and the sin fancy you, but you shall govern.
Mm.
So actually, he said that the sin wants you.
Yeah, the sin wants you. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the story is then a reference to the biblical story of Cain and Abel, Cain and Abel, where the text is it's in the Bible itself, in the text itself, that there's a suggestion that Cain kills Abel, his brother, and the idea is that somehow the sin of killing is waiting for you, is wanting you in some way. There he goes.
It's actually it's very clear, but it's anything, not only killing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But
actually he kills with the end of other the end.
Yes. Well, you see, that I think is the power of both of biblical narrative and a lot of religious narrative, is that it speaks not in terms of psychology, which I think is useful and it's attractive to us in our generation, but it somehow is limited. When you personify these forces, you somehow humanize them, you somehow give a clearer picture somehow of what it actually feels like to be caught up in the struggle with sin, or whatever you call it. And I think the Buddhist texts, at least in the Mara passages, are similar in that they too are utilizing a personified mythic language to communicate the complexity of evil, the complexity of the human condition. Can we move on to another topic?
At the back, I
yes.
don't know.
Yes, yes, please.
Yesterday we were talking about the consciousness arrives in an organism, in an object. So if I understand correctly, from this point of view, consciousness is always conditioned.
That's right.
So some condition will arise, greedy consciousness, some condition will arise, angry consciousness.
Sorry? Every?
Angry consciousness.
Angry consciousness, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So, isn't there an aim to become unconditional, to be able to be blissful, no matter what are the causes and conditions?
Yes, to some extent, yes. The way I understand this idea of the unconditioned is that the Buddha describes the unconditioned as the as the loss or the absence of hatred, of greed and delusion, which means that we can live in this world unconditioned by greed and hatred and delusion. And it's that freedom that the Buddha's teaching is working towards, so that we live not driven by our anger and our fear and our greed, but we're able to see these things for what they are, such that they no longer become the driving force, the motive, and the condition that pushes us to behave in ways that are cyclical, repetitive, and destructive. But the danger is we start to think in terms of the unconditioned, as though it's some kind of transcendent state outside the world of conditions, outside the world of causality, outside the world of change. That, I think, is not what the Buddha is saying. I think he uses the word unconditioned as a way of pointing to a possibility of living unconditioned by things, not seeking through one's meditation to realize the unconditioned.
No,
well,
no,
blissful
that,
if you're lucky, yeah, but you may not be blissful.
Contentment,
I think, would be a better word.
Be careful. I think, in a way, there is two. You see, it can go two ways. I think about this, what you're asking about, what you're commenting about. Some people are convinced that yes, you can achieve a state which will be beyond conditions. But I'm not so sure that's what really the Buddha is always talking about. Because when he talks about the four great efforts, he seems to be aware that positive conditions, inner and outer, will help you to have more positive state. Negative condition will push you to have more negative state. So he's not saying that you can be above conditions. But to me, it's more that by understanding conditionality and the condition, that then you can be more creatively engaged with it. But it does not mean that if you have a headache, like the Buddha, I mean, there is an episode where the Buddha has a headache. And he's not saying, I don't have a headache, I am not suffering. He's saying, I have a headache, I am in pain, but I don't identify with it. I just know it will arise and it will pass away. So I think we have to be careful to think that meditation, you will reach a stage where not only will you be above condition, but for all time. I am not so sure that what is what we're trying to do here. I think it's much more complex than that. And on the last day, I will on Friday, I will introduce a meditation on equanimity. And to me, there is, again, people have different ideas about equanimity. One people think that, yes, your equanimity, like you said, and nothing what happens, it's just the same to me. I'm not sure that this is what it is about. Then, I mean, a robot could be equanimous, you know? But do we want to become robots? I am not sure. So it seems to be more to be, in a way, about more, again, about creative engagement with the condition, which means that we're not exaggerating, we're not proliferating. So yes, you might be blissful, but if you are very ill, I'm not sure that you will be as blissful as if you're not ill, even if you have equanimity. Once I met this man, and he used to come on retreat a lot, and he loved to be on retreat because he would get incredible blissful state. So he was very happy always to come, and he would get them very fast. And then one time, I was there, and he said, I have a problem. And I said, oh, what is it? He said, oh, I am not getting any blissful states anymore. So I said,
what have you got any special recent condition? He said, well, my uncle died, my niece died, and my brother died. I said, well, you know, I think it's understandable, you know, that you cannot be blissful. So I think to me we have to be careful about this kind of literally thinking it means that, you know, we're above it all, and then it kind of keeps on like that. I think it's much more complex than that.
Unsatisfaction will always come back.
Hmm?
Unsatisfaction will always come back.
No, no, you see...
Well, always get again to this point.
No, no, you see, unsatisfaction comes from feeling that satisfaction must come, must be there. You see...
Yes.
Well, there'll be suffering, like physical suffering.
Mental suffering, not physical.
Even but mental suffering,
well,
yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, you could, again, you but it's how you are with it. There is this book, which is very good, with suffering, actually pain, physical pain, by this lady who is a Zen teacher. She's a Zen teacher. And up to 40, she was 40, she was fine. Really, lots of energy, really good, everything fine. And then 40, she got rheumatoid arthritis, which is very painful, very incapacitating. And then she had to learn to be with that pain. And so she used a meditation to help her to see how she engaged with that situation. And she said it depended. She had moments where she was in pain and she would get up in the morning and she would groan for about half an hour, you know. And at other time, she would just say, I would just lie down on the bed and I could not move. And then I would be aware of everything in the room. And it was like amazing, beautiful, every single thing, the light, the texture, the sound outside, everything became like jewels. It was just, she was so present to them in the moment and not expecting anything about her or the situation. And I think to me that book is a very good example of really looking at suffering and seeing that we can be with suffering in many different ways. That you can have great suffering and still have that stability, that openness. But it doesn't mean that you don't suffer, but you don't add to the suffering. And you can even create space around the suffering in such a way that it feels less painful. It's just what occurs. But that you cannot sustain it, because it's according to many different other things.
There's a passage in the Pali Canon where there is a dispute amongst the monks at a place called Kosambi, and the Buddha's there, and he gets basically fed up with it. And it says the Buddha, he says, I felt hemmed in by the Sangha. And so he has his lunch, and then without telling anybody, he wanders off, goes off into a forest and sits by a tree because he can't stand the bickering amongst the monks. He doesn't rest in a sort of blissful state, oh well, it's just rising and passing. He says, stuff it, I'm off. And a more abstract and perhaps more metaphysical account of that you find in Shantideva, this Mahayana writer I've been quoting, and he says in a very, very beautiful passage, he says, his idea is if you have discarded any kind of self-attachment or self-grasping, that makes you totally transparent to the suffering of all beings. And you then empathetically identify with the pain of the world. And he says, how therefore can the Buddhas ever experience joy when they are identifying, they are empathizing with the suffering of the world? That's another whole dimension of this. I feel there is a tendency sometimes to think that meditation or Buddhist practice is somehow about achieving some degree of total detachment whereby one lives in a bubble of bliss and the world goes on around one, but one is no longer affected by it. Personally, I find that a rather hedonistic and selfish way to consider the whole practice. Yes?
Sure. You see, I think this is very important. Yesterday I talked about mental pattern, but it's very important to see that actually the three patterning are totally connected, like the physical, the emotional, and the mental. They all feed into each other. So sometimes you might start with a thought, and then it percolates in the emotion and physical. Sometimes it starts with physical, and it just goes up. So I think it's very important to see that it all comes together. When we talk about it, yes, we separate it. But so what to do? I think to me, it's to become more aware of it. Also to become more aware of the circumstances that seems to give rise to it. Also to learn to be with it without identifying. And also to learn to be with it when it's more light. So for example, with anger, when it's kind of like really big, it's an explosion, it's too much generally, it's very hard to control, to do anything with it. But what you can learn more to do is to see when it's light. And when it's light is impatience, just impatience, to notice what is the texture, what is the kind of like that feeling sensation of anger. Does it come from frustration? Does it come from irritation? Does it come from impatience? What is it? What is a light manifestation of it, which then can make it really go psh, like you can't help yourself? And so in a way, that's why I would say with the meditation, with especially in daily life, but also on retreat, sometimes you can just try to know more the light manifestation in the body and try to be there, try to stay with it and to see how long does it last. Because generally we identify with it and we go with the thought, we feed it, and generally we act upon it. And so what is interesting is to just feel it, to just feel it in the body, in the solar plexus, this kind of like, it moves, it's, and it's kind of really to see that. Also to see, to be careful not to use it as a repressing mechanism. Because if you see it and you say, no, I'm not going to do anything, it will just build up, and then it will just be even more explosive. So to try to see what happens, what gets me, what creates, what seems to condition this state? Is it just like the fact sometimes I have not slept, I'm tired, or I have expectation, or kind of trying to see at the different level, the mental, the physical, the emotional, trying to really know it in a complex way. To me, this is a way I learned to kind of over time deal with it, to kind of start to really know it really fully. And try to stay within it in the body, to go inside it in the body and not go so quickly into the story which generally will feed it. But it's quite a powerful force. So I think one has to see that it's also energy. And so at the same time, I think it's important to use the energy in the body in a creative way so that some of that energy can be just used. And then it does not go into the anger channel. But this is a big subject.
We have 1 minute. Yes, at the back. Beard.
It's Matan.
Matan. You'll have to speak louder, I can't hear. Compassion and
pity.
Are you going to talk about this at some point?
Tomorrow, little, but you could say if you were.
Well, very briefly, compassion is the longing that others do not suffer pain. Or let's say karuna, which we translate as compassion. Pity, to me, always suggests a certain kind of looking down on the other, in a way. I pity you. I'm very sorry that you feel this way. I really feel, maybe pity is a bit closer to empathy. But compassion is very much an active wish, an active desire that the other does not suffer, or that you do not suffer. And so in that sense, it's a relationship. It's moving you to do something. Whereas pity perhaps does not necessarily imply a volition that for things to change. It could just be a feeling that, oh, that's a pity. All of these people are suffering. That's really a pity. It's an awful lot of pity. But I've got other things to do.
I think compassion is, you know, the feeling of compassion, the feeling of empathy for the suffering. And we have this compassion, as I mentioned in the first day, because we know that pain is painful and isolating. But I think in compassion also there is a certain availability to the suffering of the other, also an equality of as human beings who suffer together. And so I think there is different thing in the compassion, and that in a way, in terms of the practice, it's a practice, something we cultivate. Tomorrow I will talk about loving kindness, but it's also, I think, something that comes from the practice, insofar that in a way, the meditation helps us to remove the obstacle to compassion. And I think one of the big obstacles to compassion, as Stephen mentioned, is self-centeredness. If we're very focused on ourselves, then it's very hard to see others, to see the suffering of others. So I think the meditation helps us to open up to ourselves, but also to the world. Then we can see the other, we can see the suffering, and then we can creatively respond to that suffering. But I'll talk more about it tomorrow. And I think now, possibly we're going to eat and see if we can. I mean, how many people are suffering from this thing?
Yeah, I'm not feeling great.
So he's not feeling great either. I am not sure now, you know, I mean, maybe it's contagious. So, I mean, I hope that everybody will recover from this. And maybe tonight we might want to keep very light. You know, just, I don't know, just have something very light, lighty and thing like that. And hopefully it will pass, whatever.
Oh, it'll pass.
Yeah, it will pass.
We might pass with it.
We hope not. So all my thoughts are with you at this difficult time.
You got everything?